Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In July of 1984, an assailant broke into Jennifer Thompson Canino's apartment and sexually assaulted her. Based on Jennifer's eyewitness testimony, Ronald Cotton was arrested and sentenced to life in prison plus 50 years. 11 years into his sentence, DNA evidence proved Ron's innocence, setting him free. Plagued by the guilt of her testimony, upon his release, Jennifer sought him out, wondering how the words, "I'm sorry," could express all of the guilt she was feeling. They finally met at a church, where Ronald took her by the hand and told her he forgave her. In the ensuing years, the two became close friends and learned that healing and forgiveness often comes together. 10 years into their friendship, the two have recently co-written a book called Picking Cotton and how they tour around the country together, educating the world about the fallibility of eyewitness testimony. So, how can we learn the value behind the words, "I'm sorry"? How can we learn to forgive others and ourselves when we feel such pain inside? How, in the face of injustice, can we learn to heal our wounds and move on? On today's show, Ronald and Jennifer will be joining me as we try to answer those questions. Also joining me later in the show will be Mike McCullough. He's a psychology professor at the University of Miami, and he's the author of the book Beyond Revenge. But for now, we're talking about Picking Cotton with Ron and Jennifer. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today.
Welcome.
The book was extraordinarily powerful and well written. Jennifer, let's start with you. I'd like to hear a little bit about your story. Not that any rape is ordinary, but the one in which your life is threatened really makes things quite different. Tell us briefly what happened that night in your room.
Well, I had gone to bed very early the night of July 28th, and sometime around 3 a.m. on the 29th in the morning, I felt there was a presence in my room. It's kind of hard to explain, but I think a lot of women have identified this with me. And thought that I had heard some noises, and you know, you're kind of in that in-between state of being awake and asleep, and then I felt something brush my arm, and when I looked to the side of my bed, you know, barely awake, I saw someone's head to the side of my mattress, and I immediately screamed, and the person jumped up on the bed and quickly muffled my mouth and put a knife to my throat and told me to shut up or he was going to kill me. I was struggling to figure out what was happening, and I thought perhaps this person had been, you know, had intruded, had been robbing me, I had startled him. So I tried to offer him everything that I had, hoping that he wasn't going to kill me. And when he told me he didn't want my money, that's when I knew that I was going to be raped. I mean, I knew it. I didn't know if he would kill me. I didn't know if he would, you know, beat me and cut me. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. But the two things that I remember going through my mind very, very quickly was, if there's a way to survive, I'm going to survive. I have to figure this out. And if I survive, I want to make sure this person goes to prison for the rest of his life.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing how clear-minded you were while all this was going on. Jennifer, after the rape, during your examination, you said you wished you could take all of your skin off and have him send it away in a plastic bag. You felt like an object and you felt filthy, and a lot of women feel that way after rape. How long did that feeling last?
Well, for years, really. You know, one of the things that happens after a sexual assault, after a rape, is your body becomes the crime scene. That's where the evidence is left behind. And so, you know, I no longer felt like, and I wasn't Jennifer Thompson. I wasn't, you know, the student at college. I wasn't, you know, the person who taught aerobics and Nautilus at the place that I worked. I was no longer, everything in my life was gone. I mean, everything that I had hoped for, planned for, you know, prayed about, counted on, was now derailed and just left in rubble. And so, you know, who I had been hours before, really, in my heart and in my soul, was dead. And so the skin was simply holding this dead soul. I just wanted it to go away.
Did you want to die?
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, men particularly can't understand what this is like, but, you know, I knew that my life was forever changed, and you don't know what's ahead. And the recovery process was brutal. And I didn't even understand it for years, how I really had not recovered at all. It's terrible.
Most think a rape is a rape, and it's so much more than that.
The sexual violence is simply the weapon of choice.
Right, right. What happened to you when you first saw Ron Cotton's picture?
Because of the person I am, I'm very task-driven, and that's just who I am. I've always kind of been that way. I've always stayed that way. When I went to that photo lineup, I saw this as a test, and it was a test that I needed to pass. And so I was trying to be very methodical and careful, but the picture, his picture just kept coming back. You know, six photographs, and his was the photograph that really, to me, in my mind, was that was the person. I wanted to make sure, so I wanted to be very, very confident. So I was deliberate and slow to make that decision. So I, you know, after a few minutes, I picked his photograph up, and I said, this is the person. And they said, are you absolutely 100% positive? I said, absolutely.
And you were?
Oh, I was, yes, absolutely positive, yes.
Tell me the experience when you saw him in the lineup. I forget the details, but for some reason there was not that one-way mirror, and
no.
you were face-to-face.
Yes. We were, the police department in 1984 was undergoing a renovation, and so they had to hold the physical lineup downstairs in a basement of an old schoolhouse. And so I remember going down this very narrow, dark stairway thinking, because I had never been, I'd never been involved in any police matters, and I just knew I'd be walking into a room where they had that safety one-way mirror thing, and it wasn't the case. It was simply a room. It was a classroom that was empty, with the exception of this one, you know, 8-foot table that separated me and the seven men in the physical lineup. It was very, very frightening. It was very intimidating. I was, and because, you know, I knew that this, that I knew that finding the person and putting him in prison was riding on my shoulders, I really felt very, very internally, on my own, very pressured to make sure that I got this right. And so I wanted to make sure that he was, you know, that I picked him, that I found him, I picked him out, and that he was going away.
What was it like when you saw him? Do you remember the
film? Oh, I was shaking. I was having to very physically hold down, you know, vomit. I mean, it was. I was sick. I was nauseous. I was frightened. I was angry.
And you were confident.
I was very confident. Yes.
Your family didn't want to talk about the rape. Mm-mm. What was that like for you? I know there's this. There's with any trauma, there's a sense of being alone in the world, that no one can understand me ever again. But now your family doesn't want to talk about it.
Right. And for many, many years, probably until around 1996, so, you know, 12 years had gone by, I never talked to another rape victim. But what I learned was that this is very, very typical. My family they didn't want to not talk about it because they didn't care about me. They simply didn't know what to say, were afraid they'd say the wrong thing, probably didn't want to hear what had happened to me. And I try to equate this, and sometimes people can understand this, when you've been told that somebody you love has got cancer,
mm-hmm.
and everybody says, okay, well, we're going to go to dinner, so don't talk about cancer. It was the same type of situation with me. It's like, okay, Jennifer's coming to dinner, so don't anybody talk about, you know.
And
by avoiding that, what it really did was it made me feel very shameful, very like no one was concerned that, you know, be careful with Jennifer because you know how she is. I mean, kind of thing.
And something similar happened with your boyfriend, too. He didn't want to know. You thought this was your future husband. He asked you, you know, why you didn't fight harder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You must have had the same feeling then.
Well, not really. I mean, with him, my feeling was betrayed.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily feel betrayed by my family. I felt very hurt. I felt mm-hmm. isolated. I felt like a social pariah with my family. But with him, because he had come to the hospital, he had come with me to the police department, he had seen the aftermath of what had happened to me, he had watched me dissolve and disintegrate and just slowly die, and this was months later, this was maybe 2 or 3 months later when he looked at me and said, I just have to ask you why you didn't fight harder, you know, why?
Jennifer, can
it was a betrayal.
Can I ask you well, these are all personal questions, but I just want to change the context just for a minute, if I may. Can you tell us how you feel right now, this minute?
Right this very moment?
Yeah.
Nervous. I don't know why, I just do.
Well, I'm not worried about why, because we never know why, really.
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel like the old stuff opening up? Or?
Oh, it always does.
Yeah.
It always does. I every time I ever speak, we were together last this whole weekend with a book, and every time I get up and I have to tell my story, which is part of, you know, what I do, but every time I do it, it goes back to that place, and I always find myself at the same place as crying. I find myself at the same place as feeling pain. I find myself at the same place as feeling anger. And I don't think that's an abnormal response.
No, not at all. Well, just for the moment, let's ignore the people who might be listening to us, and let's keep it between you and me. Is there anything I can do to help you over the course of these next 40 minutes, make it any easier for you?
No, I think that where I get nervous is when people do hear me, and unfortunately they hear the last part of the program, and then they start to judge me as a bad person, and that's where I get nervous.
Right.
Because they don't understand what happens to a victim's brain underneath violent trauma,
right.
And what happens to the memory.
Well,
and then you tend to judge someone like me or the other victims who I have become friends with over
right.
the years.
Right. You said, I want to come back to the. You said that when he was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison, you said it was a happy day for you. You wished he would die miserably in jail, mm-hmm. alone and afraid, and finally you could sleep easily. Now, this kind of rage is certainly understandable, and I would think anybody would have it. But I wonder if you found this rage, in a way, comforting.
Of course it's comforting. And for me, I think part of that rage, and I told someone this weekend, for me that rage was the ability and the capacity to say, you are a terrible person, and God loves me and not you. And so for me, that was comforting to know that this terrible, terrible person was getting, you know, his just rewards, and he was going to be taken away out of society and die a lonely person. And so for me, that was, and that's the way it should be.
Did you feel better? Did you feel safer?
I think on the surface, yes. I would say yes. But the second part of that is, it was years, many, many years later before I really ever started to understand what the rape had done to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was so busy trying to fill my life with tasks and jobs and accomplishments because it was too painful to really deal with what the rape had done to me. That didn't happen for years.
The beauty of the human psyche is you feel the pain when you are able to feel the pain.
Right.
And not 1 minute before.
No.
I'm going to follow the format of the book, which I think was wonderful. Please tell Aaron, who helped write this book, that I think the way it was set up was just great. So it started off, Jennifer, hearing your story, mm-hmm. and then we heard Ronald Cotton's story. So we're going to talk to Ronald for a few minutes
okay.
now, and before we take our break, and then we'll talk to the two of you about your relationship. Ronald Cotton.
Yes, how are you doing this morning?
How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Tell
us a little bit about what your life was like before the arrest.
Well, I was in search of a job. I worked temporarily at a seafood place not far from where the crime actually happened. But, you know, I was wanting to try to get up on my feet a little better, a little more than what I were.
What kind of guy were you?
Well, I was a outgoing guy. I loved to have fun, be around people, entertain, maybe go to the bar, to the club, and just, work.
You were a young man.
Yes.
How old were you when you were charged?
I was 21.
Yeah, you were a kid.
Yes, 21.
Yeah, that's an age when we think we're grown up.
Yeah, that's true.
from when all this happened, when you were charged, from your description, you weren't very nervous. You were very confident that they would figure out you didn't do it. I wonder, I read your story. I have no idea why you were so confident. I mean, you had been forced to plead to a sexual assault earlier.
Right.
You know, that you didn't do, or you were a black man living in the South. I mean, I don't understand why you were so confident it would work out okay.
Well, because I believed and had faith in the system, by them being at law enforcement, that they would do the right thing, but it didn't happen.
No. So when Jennifer... I want to flip this story around. You heard when I asked Jennifer the experience of the lineup. What was, do you remember that moment when she picked you out of the lineup, what that was like for you?
Yeah, I remember that very day. She was instructed to, not hesitate to select the individual that she felt that looked most like her assailant, and once we went through the lineup procedures individually, and it was my opportunity. I was very nervous. I mean, I start sweating, shaky, and once he wrote that number down on that piece of paper and handed it to that detective, he looked at it and he shook his head, yes. And he walks over and showed a piece of paper to my attorney. My attorney immediately dropped his head. That was a sign already telling me I had been chosen as the assailant in the crime.
What was that like for you?
I just couldn't believe it. It's like a ton of bricks fell down on me. But I knew I had to keep myself up and together.
Yeah, that was a theme as I read the book, Ronald. That you had to keep yourself up and together. I wonder how you survive in prison psychologically knowing that you were innocent. You know, and there was even a retrial, and you got a longer sentence. Was there a point where you just gave up hope that you would ever get out?
No, I couldn't give up hope. I just had to accept a lot of things that I normally wouldn't accept. And I was determined, you know, on this journey that I was on, that, you know, someday that the Lord up above would reveal the miscarriage of justice to the eyes of some attorney.
Early on, your first year or two or three in prison, how did you feel about Jennifer?
Well, there was a little anger from the beginning, but then as I sat down and rationalized with my feelings, and you know, while I was heading in life, I, you know, had a lot of anger built up, of frustration, and I said, I can't continue on serving this time, allowing this to take advantage of me. I said, I'm not going to worry myself in an early grave. So, you know, I prayed about it, and asked the Lord up above to give me strength, wisdom, and knowledge to understand to whatever these people was doing and hoping that happened, that wouldn't happen. And, you know, just give me the strength to forgive Jennifer and move forward in my life, irregardless where I was at.
There was a point where you bumped into Bobby Poole in prison. You served time with him, and he was the man who looked like you, and you were convinced that he was actually the rapist, Jennifer's rapist, and in fact, he was. And you came very close to killing him, very close to killing him.
I did.
Did all of this affect your feelings about Jennifer, or yourself, or your feelings about God, even?
No, it didn't affect my feelings about Jennifer. It's just the fact that this guy coming to the penitentiary 94 days after my conviction, and they put him in population. And I recognized him from being local here in Burlington, and he became friends with a certain inmate, and he started researching this case. So I confronted him. Didn't do any good. He denied it.
But you knew.
I knew.
Yeah.
Because I saw the resemblance from the composite sketch.
That must have made it more difficult for you to serve your time, yes?
Well, it did for a while. You know, I dealt with a lot of anger. I used to ask myself questions pertaining to the issue. I didn't talk to anyone about it much, but I did let it be known to the Department of Correction officials, you know, what was really going on about my case. But, you know, the only response I got, well, we're sorry you're here. It's not our job to let you go. It's our job to keep you here.
Yeah, the theme I hear is over and over is not having a voice and not having a voice. Listen, Ron, Jennifer, we've got to take a short break. Ron, when we come back from our break, you know, you talked a little bit about the man you were. You were young. You were, you know, you liked to party. I want to talk about the man you were before you went to prison, and the man you were when you got out. And I want to ask Jennifer the same thing. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Ronald Cotton, who served 11 years in prison, 11 years out of a life prison on a rape charge. And he was there by and large by you know, eyewitness testimony from Jennifer Thompson Canino. Together, they have written a book called Picking Cotton. He was exonerated based on DNA evidence, and it's a story of forgiveness. It's a story of healing and bringing justice to prison. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Mike McCullough, psychology professor at the University of Miami, and he has written Beyond Revenge. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Cooper University Hospital's Heart Institute is a proud supporter of WHYY, the only academic medical center in southern New Jersey. Cooper Heart Institute provides a full range of advanced cardiovascular care, from cardiac surgery to comprehensive testing and treatment from outpatient centers located throughout South Jersey. Details about Cooper Heart Institute programs and services are available at 1-800-8-COOPER or online at cooperheart.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Google, the end of the world as we know it.
Google expanded its definition of search. It began as searching text. And then they said, well, why can't we expand search to books, television, and all these other businesses that they began to bump into?
That's media critic Ken Auletta. His new book is about the all-knowing, all-powerful, ever-expanding Google. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking with Jennifer Thompson-Canino and Ronald Cotton, who have an incredible story that they've told in their memoir, Picking Cotton. It's about a rape that took place when Jennifer was 20 years old, and she picked Ron Cotton out of a lineup. He served 11 years out of a life sentence, and only to find out that he was exonerated from DNA evidence. It's a story about their history. It's a story about their relationship. It's a story about healing and redemption. So I want to come back to our conversation with you, Ron. Yeah, I raised the question about who you were before you went into prison and who you were when you got out. You were a changed man.
I was.
How so?
Well, you know, I guess you can say I had a wild streak in me at the time. You know, I didn't really care about much, and I cared about people because I wanted to be treated the same. You know, I was raised in a family of eight, and there was more girls than there were boys, and I quit school early to help Mom, you know, around the house, make it easy for the entire family. I got involved with some other guys that went to school with, got in trouble with the law. I was placed on probation. And after that, I ended up getting a first-degree burglary, second-degree rape, which the charges were dismissed. And about a year or two later, they was thrown back at me. And the attorney, he was representing me. He stated that I was facing from 50 to 90 years for this. And it kind of scared me up, even though there wasn't a rape. So they dropped the charges down to assault attempt to commit a rape. I took a plea bargain, and I served time.
How much time did you serve?
I served like 17 months.
Tell me about the Ronald Cotton that got out of prison after he was in for 11 years. How were you changed?
Well, I was changed because I had been falsely accused, and I realized that I didn't want this to happen to me again. My first couple months out, you know, I refused to go anywhere alone. You know, I wanted to make sure I had someone with me at all times. You know, just to have an alibi of my whereabouts. And it brought me to, you know, get more into a church, be more around my family and loved ones. And it slowed me down a lot. You know, I don't like to get out and go as I once did when I was younger. Now that I have a family, you know, my life has changed totally and completely because I have more responsibilities and commitments that have to be needed and filled.
Ron, before we go back to talking about Jennifer, you touched briefly on how you forgave her. Could you tell us when the anger dissipated, when you were able to let go of the anger?
Well, actually, my forgiveness toward Jennifer went when I was in prison. Like I said earlier, I couldn't live with myself holding a grudge and considering retaliation, yet still I was incarcerated.
Why couldn't you? Many people do. Many people in prison, if not most, live with hatred and resentment. Why do you say you couldn't live with it?
Well, I couldn't function completely because I was more so concentrating on getting out of prison, not staying in. And I know that I had considered taking another man's life, that the one that actually committed the crime, but I'm thank God now that I listened to my father and got rid of that weapon. But for forgiving Jennifer, you know, it was a closing for me as well as her. because, you know, she was living in fear, knowing that I was out, and yet I won't have to come forward to where we can go ahead and close the book. So when she agreed, you know, that she'd come up to want to meet with one another, I agreed and said, okay.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. Let's switch back to you, Jennifer. I'd like to know the same question I asked Ron. What was going on in your life during those 11 years? How were you a changed person 11 years later?
Oh, gosh. Before this happened, I was very focused. I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to graduate school. I had a 4.0 GPA. I wanted to graduate top of my class. I was engaged. I mean, I just had all this wonderful plans ahead of me. And after the rape, none of it. I mean, I did graduate, but not with a 4.0. I didn't graduate top of my class. I just forgot about graduate school. My fiance, we broke up. I mean, so life for me, you know, took a very different turn. I think during those 11 years, I really struggled with, I probably my sense of self, finding my voice. I mean, I think I'd lost it, and so I didn't value probably myself as much as I should have. The recovery, like I said, was just a disaster. It was awful. So I think that what happened for me is, you know, I became even overly task-driven as a way of just keeping myself really busy and not having to deal with the stuff that was too painful.
Now that, you know, what you're saying is true for those 11 years.
Yes.
What happened to you when you found out that Ron wasn't guilty?
I think it was the first time during, you know, since the rape that I had ever really felt shameful, like really like a lot of shame, even though what I did was not within, you know, any malicious intent. It's still the end result was a man's, you know, 11 years was gone. And so I became almost debilitated and paralyzed. Like, I just couldn't. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I couldn't go anywhere. Everything frightened me. I was scared for my children's lives. I mean, I was truly, truly paralyzed by fear and shame and guilt and remorse and just, you know.
Some of these emotions are similar to what you felt after the rape.
Yeah, because everything just came back.
Yeah.
Except now, not only was I still a rape victim, but I was a rape victim who had made this incredible mistake. I mean, this was like our story became like this huge thing, you know, because Ron's DNA was the first in North Carolina.
Right, right.
The 23rd in the country, but it was the first time that the actual person had been found out using the same DNA. And so, you know, everybody was scrambling to try to find us. So now, you know, people were trying to find out who's the girl. Where does she live?
Well,
and I didn't want anything to do with it.
And so tell us about the Frontline documentary. Of course, like you said, the publicity was all over the place. Ron, you wound up on Larry King Live.
I did.
And it was there that you said publicly for the first time that you weren't angry at Jennifer.
No, anger, it wasn't there. It was like a bird that flew away.
A bird that flew away. Did you see that show, Jennifer?
I did. I did. I watched it. I have it. I own it.
And what happened to you when you heard that?
You know, I think I was just so jaded by now and so frightened by just everything that I really didn't believe it. And I think that's because I based it on my own person, you know, thinking to myself, you know, well, I sure as heck couldn't feel that way against, you know,
yeah,
somebody.
Of course.
So, you know, I was basing that on, this has got to be, you know, some ruse. Somebody's trying to set me up to drop my defenses and, you know, that type of thing.
Well, then there was the Frontline documentary.
Right, right.
So,
that came about, it was the summer of 96, so Ron had been out about a year, and this producer was trying to locate me. And he did, and he came to to North Carolina and sat with me and asked if I would participate in this documentary about the fallibility of eyewitness identification. And, you know, my first response was no, absolutely not. I mean, I couldn't tell anybody about my experience and what had happened, and you want me to, you know, like, have it recorded and then you're going to play it for millions and millions of people to listen to what I did? No. But then he convinced me that Ron had already said that he would do it, and Ron would talk about his story, and I realized that nobody could ever tell my story but me. So I would do it on the condition that Ron and I not see each other at all, because I just still believed that he had to be waiting around every dark alley and around every corner to hurt me or my children. And so I wouldn't participate.
When and how did you decide to see him?
It was after the Frontline piece aired. It aired February 27th of 1997, and I watched myself, and I heard myself talking, and I realized that I'm stuck. I'm stuck. I haven't healed. I haven't moved forward. I can't move forward. The only way I'm ever going to move forward is if I somehow, with complete inadequacy, try to tell this man I'm sorry.
We've only got a couple of minutes before our break. I'd like to hear from both of you about that encounter. Ron, you first. Tell us what it was like for you to see her for the first time since you saw her in a courtroom. What was it like to see her in that context?
Well, you know, it all started when a lot of officers on the force began to stop me, you know, to apologize to other officers that was involved in the case and tell me how sorry Jennifer was. And I said, yeah, I know. I said, but I want to hear it from her mouth, not yours, you know. And finally, when that day came, and my wife went up to meet Jennifer. Jennifer excluded each individual from the room other than myself, my wife, and her. And I looked at her sitting in that chair. She seemed like she was nervous. You know.
She did or did not?
She did seem somewhat nervous.
How did you feel when you first saw her?
Well, I was thinking to myself, what am I going to say? How am I going to respond?
You were nervous?
I was somewhat nervous, yes, I was, because I didn't know what was going to take place, you know. I didn't know how I would respond, you know, even though I understand that this a crime happened upon her, but I wasn't the one that committed this crime.
But, did you feel kindly towards her, or did you still feel afraid of her? Or both?
No, I wasn't afraid of anything like that. You know, I just wanted her to know that she can find peace within me, because I didn't want her doing just what she was thinking, which I didn't really know she was thinking that way, thinking that I would harm her or her family, which I'd overcame that.
Jennifer, tell us what happened to you in that encounter when you heard those words.
Well, prior to him walking in there, I was terrified.
Of course.
And had absolutely no idea what I was going to say. But when I saw him, you know, come into the parking lot with his wife, you know, I prayed. I really did. I prayed very, very hard that somehow I was going to have those right words. Somehow they were just going to come to me. And, you know, when he walked into the room, the only words that could possibly convey how I felt were, you know, Ronald, if I spent every second of my life telling you how sorry I am, I was crying. I don't even know how I got the words out. And I was just sobbing, and I said, I'm so sorry for what happened to you and what I did. And literally, when Ronald touched my hands and when he told me that he forgave me and he's not angry at me and that he wanted me to have a good life and he was going to have a good life, the healing that took place was so, so physical. Like, my whole body, like, started to heal. It's hard to explain, but it was truly physical, it was spiritual, it was emotional, it was mental, it was everything. And it was at that very moment, truly, that I began to heal. And I realized I had not healed for the last 13 years. at all.
I'm the host of the show, and I'm supposed to have words here, but I can't quite find any. That's not good for a host. Jennifer, thank you for what you've just said. It was very powerful and very moving. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about how your relationship developed and where it's going. The person you just heard was Jennifer Thompson Canino. She accused Ronald Cotton of a rape she lived through and lived with since she was 20 years old. Because of her testimony, he served 11 years in prison out of a life term, and DNA evidence exonerated him. They've talked about their story in a wonderful memoir called Picking Cotton. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Headquartered in Philadelphia, Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to the health and well-being of nearly 3 million people throughout the Delaware Valley. Independence Blue Cross now offers individual health insurance plans, including preventative care, emergency care, and prescription drug coverage. Further details available online at ibx4u.com. Independence Blue Cross, here for you every step of the way.
Politics, family, finance, faith. Too often the conversations are limited to who we know. But in our fast-paced world, it's important to know the new faces at the table and the new ideas that could shape our lives. Whether it's immigration, politics, or parenting, we offer real conversation about real issues. Join us as we explore what's beyond the headlines on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Picking Cotton, that's the name of a memoir that has been written by Jennifer Thompson Canino and Ronald Cotton. Because of her testimony, Jennifer's testimony, so many years ago, Ron Cotton served 11 years out of a life term, life plus, for a rape he didn't commit. We're joined now by Mike McCullough, psychology professor at the University of Miami and the author of Beyond Revenge. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be with you.
So we've heard a pretty powerful story from Jennifer and Ron. Is this typical?
Well, in a couple of ways, it is typical. When Ronald was in prison, he faced, I think, a really important choice that lots of people face when they're being eaten alive by vengeful feelings. And that choice was whether to continue to let those feelings have their way with him or whether he was going to try to take control of them in order to survive. So he did something that was very difficult, but is very typical of people who are just left with anger and hurt at harms they've received. So that's a very common hard road that people often have to take when they're in a situation where they need to forgive.
But Mike, you make it sound almost like a choice, is it?
Well, there's a hard road for forgiveness, and that's the road where you're left in your solitude to try to make something happen with these difficult feelings. And I call it the hard road because feelings don't exist in the human mind for you to control. They exist to control us.
Right.
I mean, that's why these emotions exist, and that's why, as the creatures we are, we experience them. They are designed to make us do things. The desire for revenge exists in human nature because it was good for our ancestors to help them deter people from harming them in the future. Now, the problem is, here you are, someone has done something that's landed you in prison unjustly. Letting those emotions have their way with you is not going to help you. So you're stuck having to try to change yourself, and it's very, very difficult for most people. there is an easy road, or the road, it's not an easy road in the sense of being easy emotionally, but the way the mind was designed to forgive is the way that Ronald and Jennifer experienced it when they could finally have some face-to-face and contact. They could touch each other. They could express emotions. They could apologize, express sorrow. And I call that the easy road because, Dan, I actually think the mind has evolved to forgive under precisely those kind of circumstances.
How can we move, though, from anger towards forgiveness? What's the lesson we can all take from this powerful story?
Well, the one is the very moving example of Ronald in prison trying to make a life of peace for himself in a situation that wasn't of his own choosing. It's a private project. It's a spiritual project of trying to find ways to get yourself out of these miring, vengeful feelings that we can get stuck in.
Well, I want to turn to Jennifer now, because I want to bring up an issue that's probably even more difficult than the one Michael and I are talking about, and that's about forgiving yourself. I mean, what was that process like, and have you done it? Have you forgiven yourself?
I think I can actually say yes, but it's only been after a long, 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 long road. And the only way I knew how to get there was to try to, I don't know if the word's correct, I mean, it's correct, but I'm not sure if it's exactly what I'm trying to say, is atone. And so the only way I knew to do it was to say, okay, this is what I've got, so what do I do with it to somehow make sense of everything and to bring some kind of good, some kind of positive, you know, something redemptive out of this. And so by me, you know, being an activist and an advocate for judicial reform and working in the areas that I work in, that's been a blessing for me, because it's been my catharsis, my ability to say, yeah, but I can take something really tragic and I can do something really powerful with it. And by doing that, I think I've finally gotten to the place where I can say, I'm human, I'm flawed, but I try.
The Jewish New Year coming up is all about atonement, and I think you've defined it beautifully. It's taking your pain and turning it into something devoted to the greater good. So this must have had a great impact on how you see yourself, how you experience yourself in your life, Jennifer.
Absolutely.
I'd like to hear back from Ron and Jennifer. You know, your lives are devoted to DNA testing, to making the prison system more just and more fair, but that's really not what the book was about. The book was about something different. So I'd like to hear from both of you why you wrote the book. What was the message? Ron, I'll start with you.
Well, it's allow the people to know that these things do happen, has happened, and perhaps will continue unless, you know, people come together and put a stop to, you know, honesty and more depth search of cases, and it's to allow them to know that Jennifer, she's been a victim as well as myself, and that we have come together to forgive and turn the truth around, to let them know that we hope this doesn't happen anymore. You know, we have love and care in our heart, and by reading this book that they get something out of it than just forgiveness, learn to forgive themselves.
You feel love towards Jennifer?
I do.
Yeah.
I say that and I mean that, and I stand up and tell the world that.
Yeah. And you have Jennifer.
Yeah.
What's your message in the book?
Well, I think that you alluded to that. You know, the fact is that a woman in America is raped every 8 minutes. A third of all women will be, you know, victims to sexual assault. And we've got 240 exonerees right now. which is the tip of the iceberg. And so our story really wasn't about a woman being raped, and it wasn't about an innocent man going to prison, because that's been happening for hundreds of years. Our story really was about two people who become victims of bobby pool and a flawed system, but we can triumph over tragedy, and we can heal from pain and wounds, and at the end of it, we can be better people, and we can be loving people, and we can be forgiving people, and that's something everybody has taking place in their lives, everybody.
Well, Jennifer, you know, you did it again. You know, I just, you know, you started off nervous, and that, you made me nervous twice now, because I'm supposed to have words to say, and you make these statements, and I have no idea what to say. I just want to sit with you and hold your hand and have you talk to me.
Oh, thank you.
I've been telling everyone who knows how to read to get your book and to read it. It's just so, it's a beautiful story, and it's beautifully written. And I want to thank you both so much for doing it and for joining me today on Voices. Mike McCullough, I'm sorry we didn't have more time to spend with you, but I want to thank you also for joining us.
You're welcome.
My guests today have been Jennifer Thompson-Canino and Ron Cotton, co-authors of their memoir, Picking Cotton. We're also joined by Mike McCullough, psychology professor at University of Miami. He's written Beyond Revenge. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Stephanie Marutis produced today's show. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our intern's Jonathan Glick. Una Kwan is our volunteer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.